We're going to be in here with the Mishnah on the bottom of Samach Dalet Amud Bet. Once again, the Mishnayot are brought here have nothing to do with Masechet Nazir, but rather because we brought up the term Raglaim LeDavar in the Mishnah earlier in the Perek, the Mishnayot here gather together numerous Mishnayot would have that same terminology in them, which is Raglaim LeDavar. And here the case is Hamotze Meit Bitchila. Individual finds a mate for the first time. They uncover a mate that was there. Mushkav kidarko, laying down normally. Notlo ve'et tfusato. You can take out the mate along with its tfusa or tfusato, which is the, see in the Gemara, the loose dirt that is around the mate, that if you're going to exhume the mate and move it to its proper burial location, you can't just take the mate, you have to take the surrounding dirt along with it. Shnayim. If he finds two individuals buried in such a manner, nutan vet fusatan, then he can take them as well as their dirt. Matzah shlosha, if he already hits three, im yesh ben zeleze laze midalet amot vad shmone amot, if there is between the meitim, if they're buried within four amot of each other or eight amot of each other, harizeh shchunat kvarot, then we have here is basically a burial location, which means that we're talking about a Beit HaKvarot or Shchunat Kvarot rather than simply individuals who are buried haphazardly in this area. Then that will force you to be Bodek HaMenu LaHalan Esrim Amah. That would force you then to check onward from the Meitim 20 Amot. Matzah Achad B'Sof Esrim Amah. You find another individual 20 Amot away from these three that you found originally. Then bodek menul halan esrim amah. Then you check again another 20 amot further out. Shiraglayim ledavar. Because now there is evidence, the circumstantial evidence favors saying that this is someone who is part of a shkunat kvarot. Shiilu tchila matzo notlo vetfusato. Because he had he come at this in the reverse and he had hit that one by itself first, then he would have removed it. Because we would assume there's just one individual that's buried there. But now that he already found the other three, and within 20 amot we find this other individual, we assume that other individual is not haphazardly placed there, but rather part of a shchunat kvarot. So here, the Mishnah here is based on the Mishnayot and the Gemara in Baba Batra, Daf Kufbet, Kufal Kufbet, which talks about burial caves there. And there the Gemara has numerous setups of burial caves, Machlokes Rabbi Shimon and the Chachamim, as to what the size of those caves are. So the general design of the caves are that you have a chatzer, you have a central courtyard which you go into, and then extending from there in every direction are kuchin that surround the courtyard that has burial caves in it. So there's a large area where they would gather. You find in Beit Kuvrin, you find that up in Beit She'arim. Those are things, Kuchim, which are, so if you go up to those places, you can see that they have burial caves in the stone, the actual bedrock, which they carve into the bedrock. When you go into there, there's a large central hall, we'll call it. And then off of each central hall, there's smaller courtyards that have the Kuchim that extend off of them. So Machloket as to what the size of these central halls are, as well as the side halls are. And that gets you to the 20 amot that we're speaking about here. The 4 and 8 amot are because of the extension. If you have people buried next to each other and you want to check to see how far away the other person is, then you have to cross over the empty space that would be between them. So depending on the angle that you are going at, between 4 and 8 amot would be a natural placement of the other kuchim. Again, see more of this in Baba Batra. But here the explain that it's according to the Shita, the Gemara in Baba Batra explains this according to the Shita of Rabbi Shimon in the Braita, who says that the shapes of the courtyards are such that they are 6x8. Each little courtyard which has the kuchim off of them are 6x8, 6x8. Plus you have a central courtyard which is 6x6. So when you do that, if you were to run across the whole courtyard, you would have 8 and 8 is 16, plus 6 from the middle courtyard, that'd be 22. So it's too much. So the Gemara there says, according to Rabbi Shimon, the possibility that one of the branches to the sides are not a full branch, but it's an area for burial of children or nephilim, which in their day was very common, right, with a child mortality rate of over 50%. That wasn't unusual, and therefore they had a special section for children in the burial cave. And if that's the case, then you would have 8 plus 6 is the 14, and then the last one you would say, instead of putting 8, you would say 6 because it's a smaller cave for the children, and that's how you get to the 20, according to Rabbi Shimon. According to the Rabbonon, who believe that the burial caves are 4 by 6, the burial caves are 4 by 6, and the central cave is 6 by 6, then you have 6 plus 6 plus 6 would be only 18, you don't get to 20. So the Gemara in Baba Batra explains that the Chachamim believe that one of those caves might be along what's called an lachson, along its hypotenuse. It's therefore, when you do 4 by 6, the hypotenuse is roughly 2 amot longer, which would make it roughly 8 amot. So then you have 8 amot, plus the 6 of the central hall, plus 6 of the next hall. So that's 12 plus 8 is 20. So that's how the 20 amot come about. That's how the Gemara in Baba Batra explains the 20 amot. Now, how you measure the 20 amot, according to most of the Rishonim, the way the Rabbi explains it over here, and it's seemingly from the Gemara itself, is you measure from the first mate that you found, you measure the 20 amot, not from the last mate that you found, because the assumption is that the mate is the furthest point in the burial cave. If the first one you found, then only 20 amot pass from them forward would be part of the burial cave. If you go from the last one that you found, then 20 amot would extend you too far, because then you would be past the point at which the extent from the furthest mate to the furthest mate on the other side, and therefore you wouldn't have to count from the last one, but rather from the first one, even though the Rambam says you count from the last mate that you find. It might have to do with the direction that you're going in, which is that you really have to count 20 amot in every direction in the circumference, because we're uncertain as to the layout of the mate team that you found. What's the layout? Because the kuchim that surround the central chatzer, you don't know if you found the one to the left, and you're trying to find the one to the right, or you found the one in the middle, and you're trying to find those to the side. So generally, you do it in a circumference, because that way you know you've captured every side that's around you. It depends on the size of what you think the rooms are, but how many you put in there, because we know that the standard kuch is 4 amot deep and amot wide. So depending on how big you think the side chambers are, the central chamber would be 6 by 6, so you think the side chambers are 4 by 6 or 6 by 8, then that will determine how many kuchim you can fit around, because you need an amma wide plus 4 amot. It seems from what the Gemara in Baba Batra describes is that there's a central courtyard, three directions they would have, smaller antechambers that had the kuchim in them, and the fourth side would be the entrance into the cave area. So that'd be a standard kuch. Obviously, you can have a non-standard one, but that's how they describe it there. All right, so now, in the Gemara it says, Amar Rav Yehuda, Matzah, so the Mishnah says, or describes what happened, which is, Hamotzeh Meit. So now the Gemara says in each of these words, that Matzah Prat Matsui. That Matzah means that he found now, not something that was already there. What's that excluding in this case is not clear. The Mifarish says over here, Prat Matsui was, if it was known that one of them was there beforehand, if one of them is already known from beforehand, then this isn't a shkunat kfarot when you find the other two later on. So it has to be, and we'll see this later in the Gemara, but where that Mefresh is reading it, it has to do with the latter part of the Mishnah, which is that when you find three, it's a shkunat kfarot. That's only when you find three. Either the three were known beforehand, or the three are found now. But if one of them was found now, and two of them were known before, the other way around, one was known before and two are found now, that's not a shkunat kvarot. Mostly because of the fact that either there was a shkunat kvarot, or it is a shkunat kvarot. If people know about the one person that's buried there, then they should have known about the other two. The fact that they don't know about the other two means that the other two have nothing to do with the first one who was buried there. Or vice versa. If they know, if it was a shkunat kvarot in the past, then they shouldn't have known about any of these. The fact that they know about one of them indicates that it wasn't the shkunat kvarot in the past, and that's why they differentiate. Tosafot, on the other hand, says, Matzah prat matzui perishri, shemaye yadua lo ye notlo. He says the other way around, that if the person's already known, you can't move it. So as opposed to the case in our Mishnah where you come across the mate you dig them up, then you're allowed to move the mate with its tvusa because we just found it for the first time. Had it been known that there was a mate there, you would not have the right to move the mate, because then we know that they were buried there intentionally, and it's kone makom, the mate is kone the makom, and then you couldn't move the mate. Whereas the Tosfot at the end brings down, Aval HaRashbam says that Perush Prat L'matsui, Dainu Echad Yadua, Shnayim B'tchilad B'samuch, similar to what the Gemara is going to say in a couple minutes, similar to what the Mifereish says over here, that it's modifying the latter half of the Mishnah, which is the three that you find there. It says, V'kasha L'shitato, Timkim B'chinam Nakat HaMotzei, Do a din shloshtam yiduim, teish lo shchunat kvarot. Right? Because then, why does it say amotzei? Because if all three of them are known, they're also a shchunat kvarot. So it's not just by the case of motzei when he finds them, it's even matsui. Just as long as you don't mix the two together, as long as it's three that you know about, or three that you didn't know about. So therefore, Tosafot does not favor that interpretation of the Rashbam and the Mifereish. Or you can say that matzah, prat matsui means that it's well known that the mate was buried there temporarily. And that's what it means, matsui. Then we say the next thing is, mate. He found someone who passed away, prat leharug. Exception to someone who was killed. Now, the problem with harug is either when we find them harug, they are chaserim, which means that they are not kone makom, which we're going to see in a second. That din we saw back in Daf Nun Aleph as well, that when a mate is chaser, then they don't have the dinim of a regular mate that is nikvar over there. And that's what Tosfot says over here. Mash mate shechaser in lo shkunat kvarot. That is in prat leharog. And then he writes, kashe lehavin. Lama. Why not? Shema halacha lemoshe misinaihu. He says the same thing back on Nun Aleph, that maybe it is halacha lemoshe misinai, because I can't give any logical explanation for the fact that a chaser doesn't have a din of a buried mate. Oh, so chaser in general.
We learned it.
Right, so chaser over here, according to most Rishonim, means it's chaser enough that he wouldn't be able to survive without that part. I mean, that it's a life-threatening part that is missing. And that's sufficient grounds to be deemed a chaser. But even so, Tosfot says, if he's intentionally buried there and he's buried in Beit HaKvarot, why shouldn't he be kone makom? So Tosfot says, it must be a halacha, the Moshe Misinai, and similar to what he says in an Aleph, because otherwise he says, I can't really get a grasp. I can't understand why you would say such a thing. On the other hand, the way that the Mifereish explains it is that we assume there the person, it was a harug, was that he wasn't buried there intentionally. He was either buried there temporarily because he was killed there, or he was killed and then got covered over, and that's why he remains there. But because of that, we assume that he was not intentionally buried there. So as opposed to Tosfot, who talks about the issue of chaser, the phrase talks about the likelihood that this is a temporary grave and not someone who was buried there with intent to make it into a permanent grave. Then the next case is mushkav, laying down, prat liyoshev. Right, so mushkav means that he's laying down, prat liyoshev, not sitting up. Now sitting up could be problematic either for one or two reasons. Either sitting up indicates that he was died suddenly, and then he was buried in place, or a landslide covered him over. Or the other possibility, like David said over here, which was that it's not a Jewish way of burial. And so therefore you can assume this is a non-Jew and not a Jew that is buried in this fashion. Kidarko. Kidarko means the way that Jews are buried. Jews are buried, first of all, everybody's buried in the same direction. That's number one. And number two is they're buried laying down, face up, with their feet out and their hand like wrapped around their front or on their heart. So that's a normal way to bury. Prat l'shrosho munach ben yerkutav. To exclude someone who has their head between their feet or between their legs. Again, this would be indicative of either sudden burial, being just washed over, or the possibility that this is a non-Jewish burial. In either instance, then we wouldn't deem this to be a Beit HaKvarot based on this individual who's buried there. Now, Tani Ula Bar Chanina, mate shechaser, ain lo tfusa. A mate that is chaser doesn't have tfusa, means that you don't have to collect the dirt that's around the mate. Velo shchunat kvarot. And he also doesn't generate the din of a shchunat kvarot. So this is what Tosfot said before, the harug has this din of chaser. But then, why? So that's what Tosfot says, that you have to argue over here, that this is some sort of halacha, the Moshe Misinai. So, v'ho'chani, my time alo. Why are all of these not considered to be burials? Because Amrinan Dilma Ubi Kochabimhu. Because we say maybe it's a non-Jewish burial. Again, how many of those do we say is because we think it's a non-Jewish burial versus the possibility that it's happenstance or there was a temporary burial? Will depend on what you think the reason is behind each of these items. Again, by Yoshev, you could argue that it happened suddenly, and that's why he was buried there, but not necessarily that it wasn't the Jew that was buried there. But in essence, it's not a Jewish burial because the fact that he's sitting indicates he wasn't buried like a Jew, even if he is a Jew here. And the same could be true of Ben Yair Kotav, meaning that even though he might be a Jew that's here, he's not buried like a Jew, and therefore it doesn't make it into a Shchunat Kvarot, because if he was buried, Jews bury in a very particular way, and they bury in a fashion which would be recognizable. And since we don't have that here, we can assume that it's not a Shchunat Kvarot. So now the Gemara continues and says, Matza Shnaim, Roshel Shelzeh, Bitzad Margalotav Shelzeh, Roshel Shelzeh, Bitzad Margalotav Shelzeh. You find two of them which have their head and their legs towards each other. Ein lehem tfusa v'lo shkunat kvarot. They don't have tfusa, they don't have shkunat kvarot, because that is not a burial, or definitely not a Jewish type of burial. So here, it's hard to understand what it means, rosho l'margalotav. You could have three possibilities of how to explain this. You could explain that they are buried parallel to each other, which means that they're parallel to each other, just in reverse. One head is on one side and legs on the other side, and the other one has his head where the other guy's legs is, and his feet are where the head is. So they're just parallel to each other, but just reversed from each other. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that they're perpendicular to each other, which is that one has his head and legs, and the next guy's head is by the legs of the other, and therefore there's Roshol Margalotav, and then you could say it, if you put a third and a fourth, it could be buried in a square, or some way that the head and the feet are matched up, or you could think of them in a line, which is that you have them buried, and then the feet, and then the head of the next one, the feet, and the head, so they're buried down in a line like that. The most likely scenario that the Gemara is describing over here is when they're parallel to each other, because it seems to be talking about two meitim, each one of which has his rosh connected to the regalim of the other one, and therefore it would be their parallel just in reverse, that they're buried. And again, that's not a Jewish burial, so we wouldn't assume there's tfusa or shkunat kvarot. Matzah shlosha, he finds three, echad yadua, Ushnaim Tchila. One of them was already known, and two of them are found. This goes back to the Mifaresh and the Rashbam's explanation of what Matzah, Prat Matsui was. They're relying on this piece in the Gemara, which Tosafot rejects as the explanation, but that's what they thought. He said, if you find three, but one was known, and two of them are for the first time, Ushnaim Tchila, Ushnaim Yiduim, or and that which doesn't make so much sense, it should be Echad Tchila. One was found for the first time, and two of them were known. Ein lehem tfusa. Ve'in lahem shchunat kvarot. They don't have tvusan, they don't have shchunat kvarot. The gears over here you might want to change, which is yesh lahem tvusa, ve'in lahem shchunat kvarot, which would make more sense. That they do have tvusa, but they don't have shchunat kvarot. They have tvusa because even an individual has tvusa, but they're not deemed to be a shchunat kvarot because they're not all three from the same, call it, era of burials, and therefore we don't deem them to be a shchunat kvarot. Maseh b'Rabbi Yeshvav, shebadak u'matza shnaim. He was checking, he found two meitim, yuduim, that were already known. V'chad tchila, and then they found a third one that was not known. U'bikesh la'sotan shchunat kvarot. And he wanted to declare the area to be a shchunat kvarot. Amar lo Rabbi Akiva, ko shiagato l'reiki agato. All that effort that you made is worthless. Lo amru shchunat kvarot, ela l'gimel yuduim, o l'shlosha tchila. That a shkunat kvarot is only for three that are known, or three that are found now. You can see there is a little aleph in the grah, and the grah takes out yiduin, or shlosha, because it doesn't make sense. Then our Mishnah should have mentioned that. Our Mishnah only mentions the case of hamotzei b'tchila, that you're finding them now. Shlosha yiduim, it doesn't seem to be the case here of shkunat kvarot. We don't say shkunat kvarot, elo, the gimel yiduim, or shlosha tchila, Shkunat Kvarot that we're speaking about in our case of here is the Shlosha B'tchila. So therefore the Gro eliminates the Girsa of Gimel Yuduim, whereas the Mefresh says, Ela Gimel Yuduim, Ela Gimel Shematzan Tchila, Shri Yuduim Korim Lechein, Tehachi Yud Gmiri. That's the Locha, the Moshe Misinai. Abu Ida Kisalo. Any other setup is not that way. So he points towards the Locha, the Moshe Misinai, that the halacha mishol misinai is in this fashion. If you look in the Tosafot, he also brings the Rashbam, perish halacha l'moshe misinai hu. So that's also halacha l'moshe misinai. Viri perish tam b'davar. Ri says that it is, there's a reason for it. It's not just this halacha l'moshe misinai that's this way. And so what I explained to you earlier, which is, shchunat kvarot, beit kvarot, haya ho'il v'nikvru sham gil meitim. Came into achad no dat chila. If you know one, you should have known all of them. And if you don't know one, you shouldn't know all of them. The fact that you know some and not the others indicates that we're not talking about people that are buried from the same era or have to do with each other, and that it wasn't that these three intentionally were placed next to each other, but that two were, and one was just added later, or the other way around. One was buried, and they happened to put two next to them. But it's happenstance, it's not something that was intentionally done in this manner. Right now the Gemara says, Notlan ve'et tfusatan, hechi dami tfusa. What is tfusa? What is this tfusa that you have to pick up? Samar Rav Yehuda Makra, unusatani mi mitzrayim. So here it's like the kumun of Menahani Mile, where do we know this from? So it says, when you're gonna leave Mitzrayim, Yosef says, unusatani mi mitzrayim, take me out of Mitzrayim. Mi mitzrayim tulimi. You should take some of Mitzrayim along with me, not just you take me out of Mitzrayim, but you're also going to take some of Mitzrayim with me. And what does that mean? Kama shiur tfusa, perish Rabbi Elazar. Notel afar tichoach, avachofer bebetula gemel etzbot. You take all the soft earth that is around the mate, and then you go gemel etzbot into the virgin ground, into the solid ground over there, because then we assume that you've captured all of the blood decomposition or liquids that emanate from the mate, that you've captured all of them by taking out that much of the dirt that's there. Meitave, is that really true? V'kama shu'a tfusa, perish Rabbi Elazar b'Rabbi Tzadok. So now we have a bread that says this. Notel eta kismin, ve'eta kisasot, ve'zorek eta vadayin, u'miniach eta sfekot. V'ashar mitzareif, l'rov binyano shomet, l'rov atzamot, l'malo tarvad rekev. So here, it gave a different interpretation of what tfusa is. So Elazar Rabbi Tzadok says that you take the kismin. Now the kismin over here are these wood splinters that you have. Why do you have wood splinters over here? It's probably because he was buried in an aron. And therefore the kismin are these wood splinters that you have. Others bring the possibility that the kismin over here are from the bisamim that they put in. They used to put in spices, more like atzei bisamim. They used to put in things that had some sort of smell, because in the day when you didn't have refrigeration, the decomposition of the mate left the terrible smell. So in order to cover over the smell of the mate, they used to use bisamim or vinegar. They used to use items that took away from the smell of the decomposition so that people were not turned off by the mate when they were burying the mate. So these kismin are either the aron or the bisamim. Veta kisasot. Kisasot, the easy explanation, that's what the Mefarish brings down, is that they're like clods of earth that have absorbed from the dam and the mohal of the mate, which is that the reason that they are clods of dirt is because the liquid from the mate caused the dirt to bind, and that's why you have these clods of earth there, and that's what you have to take out. Tosafot brings the possibility that the ksasot over here are actually the bisamim, that they are, like we said before about the kismim, he says that about the kisasot over here, that that's possibly that the atzei b'samim are the kisasot. The other possibility he brings is, v'od mifaresh kisasot ein lashon davar balui. Anything that wore down, and therefore would be referring to the tachrichim of the mate. So here, all these different interpretations, whether you're talking about the kismin or the kisasot, we're talking about the things that went with the mate into the kever, whether it's aronates, whether it's the tachrichim, or whether it's the b'samim, all of these items that decomposed with the mate, you take them with the mate, because we assume that they have also absorbed or taken in from the mate, and therefore you want to take them along with the mate when you zoom the mate. So then, v'zoreket v'adayinu meniachet ha-sfekot. Over here, the girsa is not so clear, but it seems, and the way that the Mefarish explains it is, that zoreket v'adayim, stuff that you know is for sure not from the mate, that you throw out. If you know for sure this has nothing to do with the mate, you can throw that out. Anything else that's a safek, that you have to leave with the mate, or you have to take it out with the mate, because we're choshesh mishom Tumah. So if you're going to take the mate out, you're going to have to take exhum these items with them. So that's the way that the Mefaresh reads this. Vashar mitzareif, the remainder of the body is mitzareif, rov binyano shomet, rov atzamot. These are all the types of tumah that we've seen before. So these items are mitzareif to get to the shiurim that you need. Ulamlo tarvad rekev, or to the spoonful, ladleful of rekev. Now this is very problematic, as the Mefaresh raises, and Tosfot raises over here, and the Rosh raises over here, because we saw back earlier that melo tarvad rekev is only in a case where there's nothing mixed together with the mate. If the mate was buried in aronates, no rekev. Buried in tachlichim, no rekev. The only case you have rekev is when he's buried in a coffin that was made out of shayish, where there's no decomposition besides the mate itself. And so then, what's the Gemara speaking about over here? So the way that the Mefaresh explains it is that Nikbar Baron shall eats in Lorekev Hani Mili Beine. That's when it's alone. Aval it's Rufid Achrine. Shnikbru Arumin Baron Shashais Mitzareif. If you want to take this and then add it to another Lorekev that came from something that was absolute Lorekev, then it works. So what the Mefaresh suggests over here is that the idea that the Rekev is only in a case where you bury it in Aron Shashayish, that's when you're speaking about the core Rekev. Once you have that core rekev and you want to add to that rekev, then you can even take it from items that have a mixture in them, because they can add. Then between the rekev and the aronates there, they'll be mitzareif and help you get to the shi'ur that you need. So by itself it might not be rekev, but together with another mate it would be rekev. The Rosh over here says that the case is Gon shnikvar meit arom baron shel shayish v'niftach arom mitachtav. The marble sarcophagus broke v'yatzai mirikvato derech Abchat v'hafar shetachad aron mitachtav who safek imafar aretzu mirikvato amate. And so what happened was that the mate, or the decomposition of the mate, seeped through the crack at the bottom of the sarcophagus. And now is the question: is this a fire that you find below? Is that from the mate, or is that from the dirt that's below? You don't know which it's from. But imsa b'toch aron uvadai, that which is found in the aron is vadai rekev. And then you add together the dirt underneath, plus that which is in the aron, and that's how you get to the rekev, according to the Rosh over here. So you have different ways to try to explain it. The other possibility is that this Braita disagrees with our conclusion of the Gemara earlier. Our Gemara earlier said rekev only applies when there's nothing else mixed in, nothing else decomposed. Over here you might have a Braita that argues on that and suggests otherwise, that rekev can even come about even when there are other items mixed into it, and that would be the simplest way to explain what is happening over here. The Gro over here says, with regards to the Malo Tarvad Rekev, he says, Nir Benai, Abba Tosefta Mefresha Safek Mitzterefim Ashar, Diner Rekev Lamla Torvad, Vodafar Kvarot. So that the way that Tosefta explains it seems along the lines of the Mefresh, which is that there's the core Rekev, and then you have Safek Rekev. That Safek Rekev can then be joined together with the core rekev. And that's what the Melo Tarvad is referring to over here, is that the other items are a safek rekev, and that you can add in to the core rekev to get to the requisite shiur that you need. So now Gemara says, Rabbi Elazar, huda marki haitano. Problem is that we have Rabbi Elazar's opinion about tfusa, but then we have a bright over Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Tzadu, who gives a different definition of tfusa. How does Rabbi Elazar deal with the fact that a tano disagrees with him? Mar says that's not a problem. He holds like this other Tana, which is the Tanya, Bakame Shiur Tfusa, Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Ben Azai, Notel Afar Tichoach, V'chufer B'betula Shloshamot, B'shlosh Etzbaot. So exactly what Rabbi Elazar says, is that you take all the loose dirt that's around it, plus you go three Etzbaot into the virgin ground that's below that, because then you're sure you captured anything that had decomposition or seepage from the mate in doing such. But Rabbi Elazar now has a Tana who he is following. Truth is, now it's Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Ben Azai. So Ben Azai would be the Tana over here, because Rabbi Yochanan is also an Amora. He's Rabbi Elazar's Rebbe. Rabbi Elazar is a Talmud Chover of Rabbi Yochanan. So it's obviously referencing Rabbi Ben Azai over here. Although the Tosafot brings the other Girsa, Perish Rabbi Yochanan, Lavainu Rabbi Yochanan Amora, Rabbi Yochanan Ben Nuri. That the Rabbi Yochanan here in the quoted Braita is not Rabbi Yochanan, like I said, the Amora, but rather Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, who is a Tano. Though it's harder because he would have been referred to as Rabbi, generally in the Braita of the Mishnah, he's referred to as Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, not Stam Rabbi Yochanan, but Tosafot is obviously bothered by the fact that the Gemara is trying to quote a Tana, and then quotes another Amura quoting someone else, but he is quoting Ben Azai, which does help because he is quoting a Tana. Alright, now the Gemara continues and says, Bodeke menu, you have to check 20 amot. Amarava badak upana. So this guy was very efficient. Badak upina. And he found one mate. And so he removed it, like our Mishnah says. Badak upina. So he did it again. He found a second mate. And he removed the mate, like our Mishnah says. Badak v'ashkach. Then he finds a third mate. But he's already removed the two mate teams. So lo hai mafni le gabi hanach trei. You don't move this one to where the other two are. Velohani trei the gabi hai chad. And you don't bring the two back to where the one is. So even though now it's clear that we have a shkunat kfarot over here because he found three. So now you have a choice. He moved the first two to a new location, but the third one is in the original location. So what Rova says is, he can't move the third one because we already established the shkunat kfarot and he can't move the third one. But what we don't make him do is bring the other two back to the shkunat kfarot because he did already. What's done is done. We're not going to force him to bring it back. Same is true about the one that is here. We're not going to allow him to move it. Once we've established the Shkunat Kvarot, we're not allowed to move it out. So basically what we say is, what's done is done. But now that we've established Shkunat Kvarot, you can't move the third one that is there. Igadam, right? Some say, Amarova came in, shenitna reshut lefanot, mefanelohom. Once you have permission to move them, you move them. Basically, Rova is saying in the Igadamre is, if he removed the first two already, and then he finds the third one, well, the third one now becomes almost like an independent. And therefore, he can move the third one to where he moved the two already. Since he already moved two, let him move the third one also and get rid of it. Gemara says, L'shavinu shkunat kvarot. Why not make it into a shkunat kvarot? Once you've established a shkunat kvarot, how can you move it? And according to the Farech, the question is, if it is a shkunat kvarot, then you should have to bring back the other two. Forget about leaving the one that's there, but even bring back the other two that he took away. So Amarish Lokish, Ila Matsu Bitiaru it Eretz Yisrael. So Ila means either Tzela, means that they found a stretch, Bitiaru Eretz Yisrael, and they were Mitar Eretz Yisrael, or Ila means that it's an excuse, they found an excuse, and they want to be Mitar Eretz Yisrael. But the basic idea here is that in Eretz Yisrael, we try to minimize the location where there is Tumah, or where Tarot will be problematic, or where Ganim can't go. And therefore, if we have any opportunity to do that, we will take advantage of that and do that. So either here, what happened was that there were rumors, or it was known that there was Tuma in these locations, and then they dug up the location, and they found these Meitim. So now what we'll suggest is that, yes, there was Tuma here, but the Tuma they were describing was the Meitim that they found, and then we can assume here that there is no more mitim that are there. The way that Mefresh explains it is, ki hadar matzah lach shlishi, when you found that third one, mafne lehu gabai, you let him move him, kedei leteher et hamakom hazeh, in order to meteher this location, kedei shelo yachzik sheish marot svivotah, shiukonim osei pesach mutarim lech sham, so that we won't establish that there really is a shkunat kvarot. And we'll know that these are just the Meitim, get it out, and then be Meteir. I mean, if we have the opportunity, and it was already done, it's done, let him clear it out, so that at least now, they won't create Tumah for this whole location. That's one way to explain it. Iged Amre Tosfot says, Afsha Shishi Mifanei L'makom Shiritze, he can move the throne wherever he wants, because Echad Lo Nitkan Shkunat Kvarot, because with one body, it's not deemed to be a Shkunat Kvarot, for Ktzad Kasha. He says, there's no logic to this, because before we say you find the third one, that it makes it into a shkunat kvarot retroactively. So he says, im alochi, if it is alocha l'moshe misinai, v'shem kol zeh min alocha. So Tosfot again brings up this issue of alocha l'moshe misinai, because he says, I don't understand the logic for this. Since I don't understand the logic, the only way I can explain it is if it is a alocha l'moshe misinai. But if it's not alocha l'moshe misinai, then I don't understand why this would be the case. And again, the answer of Reish Lakish is basically, but we don't machzik tuma in Eretz Yisrael. We try to do whatever we can to minimize it. So in this case, once you have permission or the possibility of moving it, we're going to tell you just get it out because we want to minimize tuma in Eretz Yisrael. So now, badak mesrima ma'a v'lo matzah. What happens if he checks 20 amot and doesn't find anything? My. What's the din? It's a strange question because the only reason he has to check 20 amot is because he already found three, which means you already have a shkunat kvarot. So what do you mean, mine? Mine means, what's the din? The din is that you have a shkunat kvarot over here. Doesn't matter if you find anybody past the 20 amot. The 20 amot is just a way to establish if there are more than what you found here, or to extend it beyond. But there's no reason not to believe what you found already is a shkunat kvarot. So therefore, all the Rishonim are perplexed by this and try to come up with an explanation as to what badak v'lo matza amai, what's going on over here. So the way that the Mefarash explains it is, mi amrinan came into lo matzai lahanak gimel. Since he only found three, itrume itrame did kvar halcha. Maybe it was just happenstance that they were buried here together, and it doesn't really establish that this is a shkunat kvarot. V'lo kanu mikamam, odzeoma, came into gimel, and makzikan in shkunat kvarot. But, or maybe because there are three, that establishes it as a shkunat kvarot. That's what the Mefarash says is the question. It's a strange question because the Mishnah already established that three makes it into a shkunat kvarot. And you don't need any more. Now the Gemara is coming back and saying, well, if you only found three, maybe that's indicative of the fact that there isn't a shkunat kvarot because you didn't find anybody else in the whole surrounding. That's the way the Mefarash explains the question. Tosafot gives two possible explanations. He says, the first one is, badak le'achad min aruchot. He checked one direction, didn't find anything. Does he have to check the other directions? That's the question of the Gemara. Once he checked in one location, does he have to do the whole circumference? Is one direction sufficient for this? Then he brings a second possibility, badak v'lo matza, is that he didn't go all the way down to virgin ground. He dug along the way and did 20 amot of checking, but he didn't dig all the way down. If he didn't dig all the way down, is it sufficient that he dug a little bit down and checked and it doesn't look like there's anything there? Or do you make him go all the way down to the virgin ground or the bedrock to be sure that there's no kvarot over here? So that's the nature of the question according to the Balei HaTosafot. The Rosh over here criticizes both of these positions and says, I don't understand. The answer is that you got to check. If you have to check, you have to check properly. If you have to check 20 amot, you got to check 20 amot in every direction. That means the whole circumference. Just because you checked in one way, you don't find anything, doesn't tell you any information. And the same is true, if you don't go down to the virgin ground or to the bedrock, then how are you going to know? Just because you did a half-hearted job doesn't mean that you're done. So what's the nature of that question? And therefore, the Rosh says it in the other way. The question is along these lines, which is, nearly the Faresh, badak v'lo matza mai, that this is the question. Umibayalei imutar lefanot gimu mikan, are you allowed to take away the three from here? To call them b'dika chayshina and shema marotayu. Because before we checked, we assumed that maybe these were burial caves. Kan metukanim lekvarim, that were set up for burial. Became into badak v'lo matza. Now that he checked and didn't find anything, huvrara davar, now is clarified retroactively, shein kan shkunat kvarot, that you don't have a shkunat kvarot over here, you just have three people buried here, not a whole cave system, very similar to what the Mefarash was saying, but the Rosh is giving a little more tam to it, which is that the assumption was that we had burial caves here. But if you only find three and don't find anybody else around them, that already starts to dismiss that thesis that there were burial caves here. Starts to make it look more like the fact that these people were just buried here and not intentionally or not in a permanent state. Because he says, basically, you bury meitim in a cemetery. If you only find three here, and that doesn't seem to be a cemetery, because otherwise there should be many more who should have found more evidence of there being a cemetery. People aren't buried in isolated places, they're buried together with other meitim. The reason for that is obvious, which is to minimize the extent of Tumah. If people buried people haphazardly everywhere, then you'd never know where it was Tameh, and you couldn't go anywhere. So we try to isolate the Tumah by putting all the Meitim together in a location. Also, when a Meit is buried there, it makes the place uninhabitable, or inhospitable to either planting, growing things, building a house, and so therefore it's problematic. So therefore you segregate all the Meitim into a certain location, so it minimizes the space that is no longer usable by the fact that these Meitim are there. So that's what the Rosh says the question is. And now the answer of the Gemara is, Amar Menashe Bar Yemi Amar Rav, Shkunat Kvarot. It's considered to be a Shkunat Kvarot. My daimo, Amar Ish Lakesh, Ila Matsu B'Taru At Eretz Yisrael. Now, according to the Mefarshim that say here that we're going to the Kula side of this, the answer is the Kula. Like, according to the way the Balei HaTosafot explain it, this answer says, this is the Shkunat Kvarot, and you don't have to do more work. You found what you needed to find, you don't have to do more. So if you checked in one direction, you don't have to check the other directions. You didn't check all the way down to the virgin earth, bedrock, you don't have to worry about that, because you have three here, you've established your Shkunat Kvarot, but I don't ask you to go look for more Meitim over here. That's the way that the Balei Tosafot would learn it. And the way the Mefresh looked at it is that we assume that this is the cemetery of the city, and we don't have to look for alternate cemeteries or cemeteries somewhere else, so it's also the Tzad Kula. And therefore, the statement of Reish Lakish, Ila Matsuba Taruah Deitz Eretz Yisrael, would be relevant over here, which is, why don't we ask you to do this? Why don't we press you to do this properly? It's because we want to minimize the Tumah here, and therefore, if you've established this is the Shkunat Parot, we're not going to expand that. On the other hand, the Rosh learned it the other way around. He wanted to say, well, once we establish that there's nobody here besides these three, do we now say retroactively that this is not a Shkunat Kvarot? The answer to the Gemara is, no, we do not say that. We say that it is a Shkunat Kvarot, even though you didn't find anything else. And therefore, according to the Rosh, this is a Din L'Chumra, which is that we say this is a Shkunat Kvarot, even though you didn't find any other Meitim that surrounded, which would have been evidence that this is a burial cave or a cemetery. Even though you didn't find that evidence, this will remain a Shkunat Kvarot. So according to the Rosh, where this is the Chumra, the Rosh notes over here, the Lo Garsinanach HaMaitayim Am Reish Lakish, Ila Matzu. Then you're not go-race this whole thing about Reish Lakish, because that's a Tzad Lekula, whereas the Rosh saying is that this, the answer is a Chumra. And therefore the Rosh eliminates the remainder of the gears here of Am Reish Lakish in order to have it make sense. Alright, next Mishnah. Kol Safek Nigayim B'Tchila Tohor. Ad Shelo Nizkak L'Tuma. That any Nigayim that are seen up front, or before the person is determined to be Tamei, then they are Safek L'Tahara. Mishin Nizkak L'Tuma Sfeko Tamei. Once he's already Tamei, or been determined to be Tamei, then Sfeko Tamei. If we have a Safek, he's going to remain Tamei. Basically, is Hamed Adam Al Chezkato. You put the Adam where his Chazaka is. Prior to becoming Tamei B'Tumat Nigayim, he was Tahor. So if we have a Safek, he'll remain in that Chazkat Tahara. The other hand, if he's already deemed to be Tamei, or if he's already determined to be Tamei by the Kohen, then if we have a Safek as to whether he's now becoming Tahor, we'll say the Chazaka is that he's Tamei, and he won't be Tahor until we know for sure that he is Tahor. In the case of a Safek Nega, as the Rosh points out over here from Torat Kohanim, is an instance where two individuals came to the Kohen, and one of them had a small nega, one of them had a large nega. And then after a week of Hezger, they both have the same large size nega. So one of them had Pisayon, which is that it grew in size, which would make him Tamei. The other one was Amad Beinav, stayed static, and therefore it would require another week of Hezger. But since the Kohen does not know which is which, he'll have to be Mitaher both of them, because Safek Nigayim Lehakel. And the same would be true Bituma. Meaning that if they were ready Tmeim, and then the Nega started to shrink, or the color started to fade, and now they both end up with the same Nega, but we don't know which one shrank or which one faded versus the other one that was still static. Again, both of them would be Tamei because they have a Chezka Tuma in that case. The Torah Kohanim brings it from a pasuk which says, "Vitimei oto et avadai hu mitamei." Vitimei oto is only the Kohen can be mitamei him when it's certain that he is tamei, but he can't be mitamei him misafek. And the same thing on the other side, which is vitier oto, is that he'll make him tohor is only when he's vadai and not when he is a safek. Menani mile. How do you know this? Amar Yehuda Marav Amakra l'taharo o l'tamo. So it says that to make him tahor or to make him tamei. Ho upatach bo katu b'tara tchila. Since the pasuk begins with tara, it says l'taro o l'tamo. You have to make a determination: is he tahor or is he tamei? But the pasuk began to say that he's tahor first. Iachi, the Gemara says, if that's the limud, then I feel mishnis gakle to ma'anami sfeko tahor. If he was already tamei, then the safek should always be tahor. What you're saying to me here is when you're trying to determine between Tahara and Tuma, the word Tahor came first in the Torah. So if you have a Safek, you go Letzad Kula, you go Letzad Tahara. But that's true, that should be true even after the guy is Tamei, because this is always, anytime you're in a Safek, go to Letzad Tahara. And that's not what we said. Eloki Itmar Rav Yehuda Marav, aha Itmar. The statement here of Rav Yehuda Marav is not about our Mishnah, but about another case, which is, Imbaheret kadma l'se'ar lavan, if the nega was there before the white hairs, tamei. V'im se'ar lavan kodem l'baheret, if the white hairs were there prior to the nega, tahor. One of the simanim of negaim to be tamei is white hairs that grow inside of the nega. So if we know for sure that the white hairs grew into the nega after the nega was there, then he is tamei. If we know for certain that the white hairs were there prior to the nega, then he is tahor, because those white hairs are not an indication of tumah. Safek, if we don't know which one it is, tamei. Then we say safek is the tamei. Rabbi Yeshua Amar kiha. Rabbi Yeshua says kiha. Now kiha, the word is difficult to understand. So my kiha. So the Gemara itself asks, what is this kiha? Rabbi Yehuda kiha v'tahor. Kiha means that he is mitahir over here. What the word kiha means, even in the context of explaining that he means that he leans to tahara, simplest way to explain it is the way that the Rosh explained it, which is kiha means perish tahor kamo v'nei kiha hanega. It's a nega that is keha, which the Torah describes as being something that is not white enough to be considered a nega. So keha means here that it's not white enough, and that's why it's tahor. That's the way the Rosh explains it. Others explain the word from the word keha or keha, which means, like we say in the Haggadah HaKe'ed Shinav, to knock out his teeth, which is that Rabbi Yehoshua pressed his position and said kiha. He was insistent on his position that he was tahor, and therefore he pushed it on the other individuals that was the position that he was taking. Or the other possibility is that kiha means lehita kesh. Kiha means to be stubborn or hold one's position. Or kiha means to gather together, which is that he gathered the students around, or he gathered the rayot to prove his position over here. Took a strong stance with regards to his position that he felt he was right. So Gemara says, "V'dilma keha meant tame." Maybe he meant keha and tame. That's a strange question, because if he says keha v'tame, then he's saying the same thing as the Tanakama. Meaning that Rabbi Yeshua comes to argue on safek tame, and comes to say that keha. If he says keha v'tame, then he's saying the same thing that the Tanakama says. So then, what did he add here? So the way the Balei Tosfot learn is that when he says keha tame, that he was suggesting that it should be vadai tamei, not a safek, which is that the Tanakama believes that it is a safek tamei, and Rabbi Yeshua comes along to say that it is tamei vadai. Or the Rabbi Farshim explained just the opposite, that the Tanakama believes that it was a vadai tuma, and Rabbi Yeshua believes that it's a safek tamei. The other possibility is that, as the way that the Rosh explains it over here, which is that this is just a question of menahani mile. How do you know that in this case he should be tahor? And it's again the way that the Gemara in Nazir does many times, uses a strange way to formulate something that we would say otherwise in Shas, menahani mile. How does Rabbi Yeshua have such an opinion that it should be tahor over here? Where does he get that it should be tahor? And that's what they're asking over here. Not they're saying maybe kiha means tamei, but they're saying, why isn't he tamei? Why does Rabbi Shua believe that he is tahor? And so that's another possibility as to what the meaning of keha v'timei would mean over here. Keha v'timei. Amar Rabbi Yehuda Merav, Amar Kra, l'taro l'tamo. This is the answer. This is where Rabbi Yehuda Merav's position was stated. Taro l'tamo, hoil patach bo akatu b'tara tchila. Since the puzzle began with tara tchila, therefore in these instances where it's a safek, we're going to say that we go l'tzad tahara. Now, that's the source for Rabbi Yeshua's position. But then we don't have a source for our Mishnah. The Gemara then tried to bring Rabbi Yehuda Merav as the source for our Mishnah. Now, the Gemara rejected that and doesn't give a source for our Mishnah. And so, therefore, the answer in the Mishnah, in the end, is what we said before, that it's all about chazakah. If you have a chazakah tahara, you remain tahor in a case of safek. If you have a chazakah tumah, if you have a safek, you remain tamei, and that's the reasoning behind the Mishnah. It's not anything to do with the Pasuk or Gzeret HaKetuv. It has to do with Chazaka. All right, now, next Mishnah. B'shiva derachim bodkim et hazav, ad shelo nizkak leziva. In seven ways, we check the Zav to see if the emission that he's having is not really a emission of Ziva. So now, this is true also by a Baal Keri. By a Baal Keri, also, if he has an emission, we check as to the reasoning behind the possibility of this emission. So here, the Mishnah lists out seven ways that can cause an individual to have an emission, but an emission then that would not qualify as an emission of Ziva. So we only check him before he's already a Zav. But once he's a Zav, we're not going to check him. Where that threshold is, the Mishnah will discuss in the end. But these are the seven ways that they check. First of all, b'machal u'b'mishteh. Did you eat a lot or did you drink a lot? Whether that's because the quantity of food that he consumed or the nature of the foods that he consumed that caused the type of emission. Because the eating and the drinking of a lot can cause a certain emission. And maybe that emission came because of the eating and drinking and not because he is a zav. And the Torah says it has to come mibsaro. It has to come out of him. It has to be caused because there's an emission of zav, not some external stimuli that caused the emission to happen. And therefore, we can attribute it to something else, or the cause to something else. We're going to say that this is not an emission of zav. So that's true by machal u'mishteh. It's true by masa, if he carried something heavy. Ubi kvitzar, if he jumped a lot. Ubi choli, or is he ill? He's sick. Ubi mar'eh, ubi hirhur. Now, mar'eh and hirhur over here, the mifreshim have different explanations as to what it is. The mifresh over here says, ubi mar'eh, shra'a shade, udavar acheid, davar acher v'nifchad machmato. That the mar'eh over here is that he has some sort of vision or a sight that causes him a tremendous amount of fear. And that's what a mar'eh is. And then a hirhur is if he has thoughts about a woman that would cause him to have some emission here. So that would be the difference between mar'eh and hirhur. On the other hand, the Balei HaTosafot bring down that a mar'eh is shara ish v'isha niskakim zeh lezeh. That the mar'eh is that he saw a man and a woman cohabitating, and therefore that might have caused it. And hirhur is a case where he didn't see anything, but he conjured up an image in his mind. So that would be the difference between mar'eh and hirhur, according to the Balei HaTosafot, which is mar'eh is he actually saw something. And hirhur is that he didn't see anything, but in his mind he pictured something or he had some sort of fantasy. And the way that the Rosh explains it is, b'mar'eh ra'a isha afilu lo hirher. He saw a woman and he's not having any thoughts about it or fantasies about it. And hirhur is afilu lo ra'a. But he's in the fantasies without seeing anything. Mishin iskach l'tziva ein bod kimuto. Once he's already a zav, we don't ask him any of these questions anymore. Onso usfeko v'shechvat zoro tmeim. And therefore, all these items that in his first sighting would not be counted towards Zav, now in the sighting where he's already Tamei, in his third sighting, that would be problematic. That is, Onso, if it happened, even if it happened because of some external stimuli or something else that caused it, like one of the seven things we mentioned above, didn't come out of Bisaro, wasn't a natural emission, but an emission that came from something else. Usveko, we're not certain how the emission or whether it was an emission. Or Shikvat Zaro. Or we know for certain that he had a seminal emission. Nevertheless, we believe over here that he is Tamei. Because the way that, as the Mefresh points out, is that even when you have these emissions, we assume that these emissions also come with some sort of emission of Ziva with them. There's got to be something that comes out with them. And why do we assume that that's the case? Shiraglayim l'davar. Because we already have evidence to that fact. So the way that it works by a zav is that a zav, after his first emission, has the same din as a balkeri. She said he has tumat erev. He's tamei for one day. He goes to the mikveh, the sun sets, and he is tohor. And all of these checks would be done. If a zav sees a second emission, then that second emission makes him into a zav where he'd have to wait 7 days bitahara. At the end of the 7 days, he goes to the mikveh, has erev shemesh, and he's done. Then there's a Zav who has three sightings. If he has three sightings, he's the same as a two-sighting Zav, which is that he has to wait 7 days, b'tara, go to the mikveh, but then he also has to bring korbanot on the eighth day. But the way that the Mishnah sounds is that for the first emission and the second emission, we let you check to see if there was something that caused the emission to happen, because we're only establishing the fact that this guy is a Zav at this point in time. Once you've already established that he's a Zav by having two emissions, the third emission, we assume, is an emission, and we don't give him any of these outs or these excuses, because it seems that we already established the fact, regarding the divide, that he is having these Zav emissions. And therefore, we assume that the third one is also a Zav emission, even if it happens in a manner by which it would not be considered so for the first two emissions. Hamakeetz chaveiro, someone who injures his friend, b'amdua l'mita, and they assess that it was a life-threatening blow, to the extent that this person now is bedridden and is going to die. So in a normal case, if an individual hits his fellow Jew, then he's responsible to pay for the damage that he's done, and the chamishat varim, which is nezek tzar, ripoy boshet, and shevet, and you have to pay for the five items that are associated with nezek, and he has to take care of this individual. On the other hand, if they assess that he's going to die, then he doesn't have to pay for these items because now he's chayav mita, and they lock him up in jail until the person, we determine what happens with him. If the person passes away, then he's going to be chayav mita. The person survives, then he'll have to make whole on the money. He's going to have to pay for the nezek that he did and pay the chamisha dvarim. So here is an instance where he hit his friend, and the Beit Din assessed that this individual is going to pass away. So now he's not chayav in nezek, he's just locked up until we figure out what's going to happen. Vehekel. And then this individual got better. The individual that was been hit now gets better. Mimashaya. Better than he was in the original state. So he started to improve. He started to get healthier. And then things take a turn for the worse. And he starts getting worse and he dies. Chayav. The Tanakhama says, the individual who hit him is chayav mita. They assessed him to die in the beginning, and he died in the end. So even though he went through a period of a little improvement, that's not enough. Even though he got a little better in the interim, that was just part and parcel of the natural flow of the individual. And when he dies, we assume that's because of the original hit. Ibn Chemi Omer Patur says, Patur Shraglaim Ludabar. Because here we have evidence to the contrary, which is the fact that he started to get healthier, and he started to improve his condition, shows you it was not the original blow that killed him, but rather, as if things persisted, that's what caused them to die. And he was getting better from the original blow, and therefore this individual is not chayav mita. So now Gemara says, Menahane mile. Where do we know this from about the Zav? Rabbi Natan Amar Kra, Vazav et Zovo. That the Zav et Zovo, there in the Pasuk, it's comparing the Zav to a Nida, or to a Zavag Dola. Now by a Nida or Zavag Dola, the emissions from a woman do not have all these qualifications, but we say if it's caused by some external stimuli, that she's not Tmeya. A Zavar Nida that has a menstrual flow is Tmeya no matter what. Ben the Onso, ben all the reasons that we gave over here, it doesn't really matter why she has the flow of blood. As soon as she has it, she is Tmeya. So what the Gemara says is that a Zavet Zovo is paralleled to the Nida or to the Zavag Dola in the case of a Zavet Zovo, when it's already had two emissions. The word Zav and Zovo appear in that pasuk. So once he's already had two emissions, he becomes like a woman. He becomes like a Zava, which means that we don't care anymore what the cause is. If you have an emission, you are Tamei. L'riyashli sheet itkish l'nekeva. Only once you hit the third sighting is she like an Ekeva. And Zov and Zovo is already a sighting, two sightings Zav. Then for the third sighting, we say that the Zav is like a woman, which is that we don't consider it. Vatanyo, don't we have a bright the Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Bishlishit Bokimoto Brivit Ein Bokimoto? He argues that the threshold is one further along. She says that for the first three emissions, we check the Zav. For the fourth emission, we don't check the Zav. Well, what do you have to check the Zav anymore for the fourth emission? Once he hits the third emission, he's at the highest level of Tumah that a Zav can get to, which is now he has to wait 7 days and bring a Korban. Having a fourth emission at this point in time doesn't change that. He's still going to be in the same predicament. So what does it mean, ain't both kimoto? Because the fourth emission would undermine his shiva yamei tara. He's keeping his shiva nikiim. And if he has an emission in the middle, that would be soter, and he have to start his shiva nikiim again. This sighting that he has any time to the shiva nikiim will undermine his shiva nikiim. So it is important. The fourth emission is important. So over there, by the fourth emission, we don't ask questions. So Gemara says, Ella be'atim kamifuge. The machlok between what is said by Rabbi Natan and what is said here by Rabbi Eliezer revolves around the word et. Rabbi Eliezer darish etim. He's derish the word et, and therefore you have vazav et zovo. So therefore you have three sightings there. That means for the three sightings you do need to check. For the fourth sighting you do not need to check because that's when there's the hekesh to the nekeva at that point in time. Now Rabbi Eliezer's position makes a lot of sense because once you hit the third, you're now at the full state of Tumah that you can be for a Zav. So for the first three, I need to check. The fourth one just keeps the status quo intact, which is that he's now a Zav, and he will remain a Zav. And therefore, that's why, according to Rabbi Eliezer, the threshold is 3 to 4, because at 3, each one of the sightings up to three make a difference in what the tuma is. Once you get to sighting number four, it no longer makes a difference about the level of tuma, just sustains the level of tuma. It doesn't allow you to get out of the tuma. That was the explanation of Elazar's opinion. The Rabbanon lo dar she'etim. And the Rabbanon are not doshereish the word eight, and therefore they only have zav et zobo, which is two sightings. And then the third sighting you don't have to check, because the third sighting has ekesh to the nida, the zavak dola, to the woman, where we don't ask questions. If you have an emission, then you are tamei or tmeya. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the bottom of samachayim with bet.